My name is Zachary Weber. I'm the staff educator of adult programs here at the Carnegie Science Center. So I'd like to welcome you to our Cafe Sci program. Our speaker tonight is Georgina Terry. She is the founder of Terry Precision Bicycles in based in Rochester, New York?
Burlington, Vermont now.
She has 2 degrees from the Pittsburgh area, though, from Chatham College and Carnegie Mellon University. And she'll be giving us a presentation about bikes and bodies tonight. So join me in welcoming Georgina Terry.
Thank you. All right. How's the volume, Zach? Good? Okay. If you can't hear me, tell me and I'll tell Zach. Thanks, everybody, for coming tonight. This is going to be a multimedia presentation. First, a little keynote presentation, and then I'll get into some wild drawing in which you'll see that I cannot draw circles perfectly by any means. But let's start off here with a little bit of a slideshow just to get things going. All right, the title of this presentation tonight is Bikes and Bodies. And what we're going to be talking about is men's bodies and women's bodies, how they're different, and how that affects the way bicycles are built and the way a bicycle feels when you ride it. And I think you may have come to this with some ideas of why they're different, and I think I'm going to surprise you when I introduce some new ideas here. Let's go back to about 1985, which is when I founded Terry Precision Bicycles for Women. And this was our mantra back then, have a fit, with a nice double meaning. Have a fit, because if you're on a bike that fits right, you're going to love it. And have a fit if somebody tells you they just don't make a bike that fits you, because they should, darn it. And that was the whole reason for being. Now, I got into this whole thing of building bicycles for women as opposed to women and men or children or anyone else because of the complaint I used to get from female cyclists. And the most popular complaint I got was, I'm so short, I can't clear the top tube, which is also known as the crossbar of the bicycle. So I thought, all right, well, let's look into that a little bit and see what's going on. Now, this is where we get into the café scientifique part of this. I will not be accurate to many significant digits. That would be Cafe Scientific. This is Cafe Scientifique. This is a normal curve or a bell curve of women's heights and how often those heights occur. Now, how might I drive this curve? If I went to every woman in the room here and I said, please call out your height, and I started writing them down, I'd find out that more women in this room were about 5'4 than any other height. They get down into the tails, and you get down into under 60 inches, under 5 feet tall, a little bit over here taller. But the main one is about 5'4". And of course, the question is, are we talking about 20-year-old women, 30-year-old women, 80-year-old women, fit women, unfit women? We're just talking about women. We're going to be very general with this. So here's the way the curve looks for women. Now we go out, and we're going to do exactly the same thing for men. And look at those two curves next to each other. Now, here's the men's curve. The average guy is about 5'10". But notice that his curve kind of spreads out a little bit more than her curve. I mean, the full population of men are darn close to it. It's going to accompany a much wider range of heights than it is for women. Now, back in 1986, when a woman came to me and said, I can't clear the top tube, chances are she was around 5'2", maybe 5'3". Because the way the industry was building bicycles then, if you were shorter than that, you really couldn't clear the top tube. So let's go back and look at that. Here's a line at 5'2". And what I'm interested in now is all of those people to the left of that line. If I look at the men, it's that little chunk there. That little bit of area is the proportion of men that are going to be under 5'2". Holy cow, look at the women under 5'2". I mean, that is phenomenal, significantly more. So back in 85 or so, there were an awful lot of women who were out buying bikes, and when they got off them, they kind of had to lean to the side because they couldn't stand up straight. You know, just putting up with stuff that didn't work out right. So that was the first thing that got into my head was we've got to start making bikes in smaller sizes to fit women. Now, what other common complaints was I getting from female cyclists then? Well, my neck and shoulders hurt. My low back hurts. extension of this, my crotch hurts. Again and again and again. You know, I have to admit that when I first started hearing a lot of these things, I was kind of like, I guess some people in bike shops were, which were, well, you have to ride more. You got to get used to it. You know, you get more fit, that'll go away. You'll feel more comfortable. But I just kept hearing this over and over again. I thought, whoa, something's going on here. This started to give me some ideas about what was going on. I call this a short course in anatomy. And what we've got here, a man and a woman who are the same height. And you probably notice this when you're just walking down the street looking at men and women walking next to each other. She has much longer legs than he does, even though they're the same height. She has a shorter upper body. She has longer legs, shorter upper body, shorter arms. So even if she finds a bike to fit her legs, because her upper body is shorter, and because her arms aren't as long, it's like sometimes the handlebars are out in the next county. You know, you just feel like they're a long way away. You've gone to the bike shop, and they've tweaked the stem length, and they've raised the handlebars, and they've done tons of stuff, but it's still very uncomfortable. Now, my solution to these problems that we've been talking about was, first of all, as I said, to offer a range of sizes to fit women from about 4'10 to 5'10 in height. In addition, my bicycles featured shorter top tubes so that women could sit a little bit more upright to get rid of the shoulder and the small back discomfort that they had. When we started building bicycles like that, bicycle sales went through the roof. Now, being a good engineer, or maybe not such a good engineer, I started thinking more about that short upper body, long legs kind of thing, and I thought, I want to attach some numbers to this. I mean, right now we just have anecdotal evidence. We're just looking at people, and we're saying, based on how they look, this obviously has to be the case. So I started doing some research, and I found out that Wright Patton Air Force Base had done a study of women's bodies, I mean, thousands of women's bodies, you know, for the purposes of uniforms, using machinery and equipment, all this kind of stuff. And I got these things from the library. I mean, books just stacked like this one night. And I started going through them like crazy. And I ran into this huge problem. Women's legs weren't shorter or weren't longer. Women's upper bodies weren't shorter. As a matter of fact, the exact opposite was true. And I, like, kind of flipped out because I looked at this and I thought, wait, this has to be true. I mean, look at where our waist is. How could this not be true? We see this all the time. Yeah, but you don't bend from your waist. You bend from your hips. You know, your waist can be way up here and never get touched in a bend. So I had this dilemma. The science was not supporting the anecdotal evidence. How was I going to explain this? I mean, I was really worried. I felt like a total sham. The bikes were doing well, but I didn't have the right reasons, and that really bothered me. That wasn't clean engineering. I think T.S. Eliot said it the best way, the last temptation is the greatest treason, to do the right deed for the wrong reason. So I had to get to the bottom of this. And since I had been a student at Carnegie Mellon University, I went back to Carnegie Mellon University and talked to a professor there by the name of Mark Nagurka, who was teaching biomechanics, I think. And I said to him, you know, I've got this dilemma, and everything I'm doing says it's wrong. Can you help me with this? Do you have a student here who might want to work on this as a special project? And he said, yeah, I do, as a matter of fact. So he introduced me to a woman by the name of Laura Lund, whom I believe is still in Pittsburgh and is teaching at the University of Pittsburgh in engineering. And she wrote a paper entitled Bicycling for Females and the Associated Pain. And I was like, ah. And this, wait till you see what she found out. This is really quite interesting. It's very difficult to explain from a marketing standpoint, which is probably why you don't hear about it. But you'll see what I mean. Laura, in the beginning, found out the same thing that I did. Women have longer arms and shorter legs than men. Women have longer torsos than men. She then asked the same question. What's the issue, if that's the problem? And then she dug just a little bit further and hit pay dirt. And pay dirt was this: women's body mass is not distributed in the same way as men's. Everybody's eyes just glazed over. Don't worry, I have nice drawings that will explain this, I think, a little bit better. because it's a simple thing to understand, even though it sounds kind of crazy. This is kind of how we thought about women, you know, that in your torso, your mass is down here somewhere, and in your arms, your mass is more likely to be up in the upper arm area and not so much in the lower arm area. When actually, we should have been thinking of women like this, with that center of mass moved up a little bit more and down a little bit more, further away from the shoulders. Okay, let's look at it again in another way. Here's a man who's leaning over. Now, if I could take all the mass in his upper body and just put it in one place on his body, where from an engineering standpoint, it would cause all the things to happen that distributed mass does, we would see that it's low on his body. Now, this is exaggerated a little bit, but it's to make the point. It's higher on a woman's body. So here, think of this as a thought experiment. Suppose you're leaning over, and I put a 10-pound weight back here on the lower part of your back, and I say, stand up. You stand up. I say, okay, lean over again. I'm going to move that 10-pound weight up closer, higher on your body, further away from your back. You know for sure it's going to be harder to stand upright. I mean, you just know that intuitively. You don't need to be an engineer to figure that out. That's kind of the essence of what's going on with center of mass. Since it's distributed differently on a woman's body, it's causing different things to happen when she gets on a bicycle in a certain position. Now, if we start to refine this a little bit more, this is where it gets really into more engineering, but this is such a beautifully elegant, simple little formula. I'm going to talk frequently about the moment around the lower back. And the moment is simply, there's the force coming down from the center of mass. And it has a perpendicular distance back to these muscles that are supporting that force. And the force times the distance gives you the magnitude of the moment. So you can see as the force moves closer to your hips, D goes down, moment goes down, right? Now let's take that, now that you understand the concept perfectly, the idea of this force and moment. But now this will make a lot more sense. Now let's apply it to a woman on a bicycle. We'll apply it to a lot of women on a bicycle, women of all different sizes and heights and limb lengths and everything else. But this is the basic formula that we're going to use. And you'll see there are three dark arrows. These are the ones that Lund was most interested in. The one on the left is coming from the lower arm, then the upper arm, and then the upper body. That force from the upper body is creating the stress on the lower back. The ones in the arms are creating the stress on the shoulders as the shoulders support whatever the arms are doing. So Lund went back and she said, I'm going to look at a variety of lengths of bicycles, and that's going to change the angle of the rider, and I'm going to calculate these moments, the stress on the shoulders and the stress on the lower back. I'll do it for both men and women, and then I'll compare the two to see what I find out. When she did that, she found that for any man and woman of the same height, this is averaged over everything, that the woman must support greater or equal moments in her shoulders, forces, with muscles that are on average smaller than a guy's muscles. And the same thing was happening with the small of the back. Muscles smaller on average than a guy's, but moment larger. And that was what was giving rise to this feeling of wanting to sit more upright. Because you're just incurring, that's why you're incurring more stress. It's not the length of the limb, it's where the weight is centered on the limbs. And you probably will never hear anyone ever speak about that. Anyone who's making women's bicycles, you'll still hear, you have longer legs and a short upper body, that's why we make women's bikes. Because as you can see from this, this is kind of a complicated thing to explain to someone. You know, I'd love to see a marketing firm really get their hands on this and do it in a real palatable, sexy kind of way. But this is really what's going on. In the end, this is the reasoning. Now, having said that, since we've talked about women being on the shorter side and where all these muscle masses are, I want to introduce you to, not really, she's in England right now, a woman by the name of Eileen Sheridan, who back in the 1950s broke 21 place-to-place records in the United Kingdom. Place-to-place records are rides like from Land's End to John O'Groats, from London to York. I mean, they're anywhere from 1,000 miles to 100 miles. And she broke them like crazy. 5 of them still stand today, have never been broken. But here's the most amazing thing about Eileen Sheridan. She was only 4'11 at the time, which kind of blows your mind because you're going, wow, 4'11, back in those days, they really weren't making small bikes, yet this woman was kicking butt, as they say. She was really making a name for herself. Here's how she looked on a bicycle when she was competing. And you can see that she is like flat. I mean, she has to be. Those handlebars are pulling her all the way out. She has no choice but to ride in this position. It's amazing to look at the length of her forearm compared to the drop on those handlebars. I mean, the handlebars are just massive. I went back to the wheel size on this bike and calculated that this bike is probably a 20-inch square bike, which means the center-to-center distance in the seat tube is about 20 inches, and the center-to-center distance on the top tube is about 20 inches. Now, bikes I build today for customers that size have a 16-inch seat tube, 4 inches shorter. But here's what was happening when she was leaning that far forward. She was a swimmer, so she had good upper body strength. She was doing two things. First of all, she was becoming very aerodynamic on the bicycle. But the second thing was, when she was leaned over like that, she was getting maximum use of the gluteals, the muscles in the butt, which are your strongest muscles for cycling, which made her an incredibly popular and successful competitor. And as she said, they all laughed at my handlebars, my great big handlebars, but I got into a lovely flat position. I mean, they weren't really thinking about aerodynamics that much then, or the physical aspects of things. They just got on the bike and ride. She said, I used to lie almost on the tip of the saddle. And then she points out, and all the fast men now, and she's talking about time trialists when she says that, they're down very flat, and they're right on the tip of the saddle. And that's how she found she was doing her fastest times. I mean, that's a pretty incredible story. I don't think Eileen Sheridan could have ridden a bike casually, because the bike was too big for her to sit up and get into a casual position. She had no choice but to be competitive on a bicycle. I mean, that's pretty mind-blowing. All right, now let's switch to the other part of this multimedia production, and we're going to look a little bit at frame geometry, which is where I get to draw some really good stuff. Okay. All right, now let's see how this works. Oh, yes, blinds me perfectly. All right, good. All right, can everybody see that? Am I in people's way of seeing it? All right. All right, we'll start there. Now, first thing we need to do is, if we're going to talk about bicycles, we need to know what the parts are. Otherwise, it's going to get confusing kind of quickly. So, does that show up? Yeah. Let me just draw a bicycle here. Here come those wheels. All right, now, this is pretty simple. This tube up here is the top tube. It's at the top of the bicycle. Easy way to remember it. This tube down here is called the seat tube. It runs under the seat. This one is at the head of the bicycle, so I'm going to call it the head tube. And this one is way down here, so I'm just going to call it the down tube. All right, everybody's with me? I move that up a little bit. How's that? Maybe a little bit better? All right. Now, back here, these are the stays of the bicycle. And this one, again, is under the seat, so it's called the seat stay. The chain pretty much runs along near there anyway. So this one is the chain stay. All right, everybody got that? We're down pat. We can move on from here? Okay. Now, let's just pretend that this is where you'll see how the geometry really comes into play. Let's just pretend that I'm trying to design a bicycle for a very small woman. What are the constraints that I'm going to run into? What am I going to learn about how bicycles are put together when I start to do that? Well, let's just start off again with a bicycle. All right. All right, bicycle. Now, for talking purposes, I will say this bicycle has, like Eileen's maybe, a 20-inch seat tube. My customer's pretty small. She can't straddle the top tube. So the first thing I do when I look at this is I say, I need to bring the top tube down. I'm going to bring it down there. And I'll bring it down here. Everything's looking pretty good. Every time I bring it down, I'm just going to move the seat stays down a little bit. I'm going to get rid of all this mess up here. My bicycle is slowly becoming smaller. Looking good, right? Now, I get to a point, though, where I'm starting to run into a little interference here. And that's coming from right here in the head tube. As you can see, as this top tube comes down, it's kind of cutting off bits and pieces of this head tube. It's getting to be smaller and smaller. Now, the head tube can only be so small because there's a lot going on at the head tube. It's the junction of the down tube at this point, of the top tube at this point. This bike has lugs on it, which are steel sleeves or metal sleeves that the tubes join into. There's got to be room for the lugs. Even if it's TIG welded, there has to be room for the welds around these joints. And the other thing that's happening is the bearings for the fork turns and bearings that are embedded in the head tube are here as well. And if you get those bearings too close to each other, you're asking them to contend with the movement of the force while they're really close together, which means they really go through a lot of stress. They probably aren't going to last as long as bearings that are out further. Imagine if I were holding a broomstick in my hands, I put my hands out here and I say to you, twist the broomstick. I can work against you pretty easily, but as I move my hands closer together, it's a little bit easier for you. So this starts to limit things right here, the length of this head tube. That's one of the problems right there. As a matter of fact, what I find out is that using the shortest head tube that I can, the length of my C tube, instead of being around 20 inches, is as long as I keep this top tube horizontal. And there are bikes with sloping top tubes. That introduces sometimes good things, sometimes bad things. We'll get into that. As long as I keep this top tube horizontal, I'm really limited pretty much to maybe around 18 inches or so on the seat tube, and that might not be quite short enough for my customer. Well, I'm going to worry about that later, okay? Let me address another problem that's coming up with this bike. If she's so short that she's riding a bike that's that small, we have another issue with this bike. And we'll draw it again here. The other issue is the length of this top tube right here. Because obviously, if she's short, she's going to have short arms. She's not going to be able to reach as far. So now I have to think about shortening the bike up this way, moving front towards the rear or the rear towards the front. It doesn't really matter. And I see one thing that I can do that's kind of interesting. One item we didn't talk about, we've talked about the parts of a bike, was this angle right here between the top tube and the seat tube. And that angle is called the seat angle. Everything fits in rather nicely. Typically, on road bikes, you'll find seat angles are between about 72 and 74 degrees. They tend to be steeper on smaller bikes and shallower on larger bikes. But being a clever designer, I realized that the seat angle is key to the length of the top tube. Notice that as I make the seat steeper and steeper, I mean, here's really a steep seat. This is a 90-degree seat. You never see that. But what you're seeing is that as the seat tube becomes steeper, it's cutting off little chunks of top tube, right? So, I mean, I could put like a 76-degree seat angle on this bike and cut off a whole lot of top tube and reduce that distance. Well, that's not really a great way to do it, unfortunately, because we do have a human being who's got a ride on this bike. And if you start making this too steep, what happens is the rider's saddle position is forward a little bit too much, and she may lose the relationship between her knee and the pedal, which is key to giving her the proper amount of biomechanical relationship. So you will see this done occasionally on some really small bikes, but it's not a really good way to do it. And here's what happens. You get on this bike with a 76-degree seat and go, can I push the seat back any further? And you can only push it back so far, because you can effectively change the seat angle by moving the seat forward and back. So I say, okay, that's not real good. I'm gonna stick with maybe 74 degrees as a maximum seat angle. I'm comfortable with that. The other thing that I could do is I could give this bike more rake. rake is just this distance right here. It's that distance that the fork swoops out. The other thing I could do, this is another angle up here called a head angle. And typically it's running between maybe 72 and 74 degrees. I could make it really shallow, which would, you know, start reducing the top tube in the other direction as well. But if I decided I didn't want to make any of these compromises, the bike that I would be left looking at would be the one that has about an 18-inch seat tube. And because I'm a really conservative designer, some people laugh at it, about a 20-inch top tube. Still not a good solution. But there is a better solution. And some of you may know what that is. The solution is, let's go back to this bike. All right, it's got these wheels on it. Another thing I should say is, as the top tube gets shorter, if you're thinking of it as moving the front of the bike towards the rear, the wheel is coming closer to the pedal. And you can end up in a situation called toe clip overlap, in which on, we used to call it something else, but this is a nice audience, so I won't say that here. On sharp turns, you might actually have interference between the pedal and the front wheel. It will never happen while you're riding a bike at a reasonable speed, going around corners or anything. It catches you when you're doing loop-de-loops in the parking lot, or when you just start up from a stop, and there's that moment of uncertainty where you just got to catch things really quickly to get your balance underneath you. That's when it can get you. So that's also hindering how short this top tube can be. But notice, if I will put a smaller wheel on the front, and I can really do anything I want in the back, but if I put a smaller wheel on the front, a whole bunch of problems just disappeared. I mean, like zillions of problems just went away. The first thing is, the down tube, instead of being way up here, too bad, oh, look. Yeah, okay. The down tube, instead of being way up here, because this wheel is way down here, can now be way down there. And if the down tube is moved down, now the top tube can really come down before I run into this issue of a teeny tiny head tube. And voila, there's my 16 inches right there on the seat tube length. And the other thing that's happening is this top tube can be a lot shorter because this smaller front wheel is miles away from that pedal. As a matter of fact, it can be probably around 19 inches or so. So that is, some of you may know, this has been the hallmark, it still is. People think I don't continue to build bicycles with small front wheels, but I do, in the very small sizes, because it's a really elegant way to get rid of this problem. The most common complaint you get is, I won't go as fast. Really? Why not? Well, because that front wheel's going around, you know, like 33% faster than the rear wheel. Yeah, so it doesn't matter because your gears are on the rear wheel. You've got the same gears that the guy 6'2 next to you has if you're both riding the same rear wheel with the same gearing. So for one rotation of the pedals, you're going to go as far as he is. Yeah, that little front wheel might be going blah, blah, blah. But the bike's velocity is the same. So that's not going to change at all. The other complaint that you sometimes hear is that it looks funny. You know, it just looks weird. Well, I look like I'm in a circus. I don't want to ride a bike with a small front wheel, you know. And I have to be perfectly frank with you. I never ran into that problem of looking funny much in the late 80s and the early 90s. I mean, that was kind of the I am woman, hear me roar era. And it was like women were almost saying, I am different, and I don't mind looking different, and if my bike looks different, I think that's really cool. But women have kind of changed a little bit now. They don't want to be different. They want to be just like everybody else. Don't single me out for anything different. Just give me stuff that works, and let me look normal with my equipment. So it can be a little bit harder. And I have customers who are willing to make compromises in order to avoid doing this. Which is kind of cool. There is another solution to this. It doesn't buy you quite as much. And that is, here we go with this bike again. show you some kind of interesting things here. This is, you can't tell from looking at the wheels, but this is a wheel called a 650C, which is a 26-inch road bike wheel. And it's a little bit smaller. Let's see, 571, 22. It's about an inch smaller in its radius than a 700C wheel. But just buying that inch on the radius, again, gives you a little bit more to work with on the head tube and a little bit more to work with in this respect right here with front to rear. Now, it's very interesting because a lot of manufacturers who make so-called women's specific designs until recently were mixing 650 into that group. You'd see their smaller women's bikes with 650C, their largest women's bikes went back to 700C, and then all of a sudden, all the 650C bikes disappeared. It started happening about 3 years ago. Specialized never did buy into this, but Trek dropped it, Felt has dropped it, some of the other manufacturers have dropped it. And I had the opportunity to talk with someone in the industry and ask her why their dealers, why they weren't even making this bike anymore. And she said it was because the dealers were pushing back about 650C wheels. And I said, really, what was the pushback? She said, well, they didn't want to carry an extra tire size. And I thought, that's the biggest bunch of BS I've ever heard. And it is, because the industry is going nuts right now with crazy tire sizes. 29ers for mountain bikes, which are really 700C. 650B. 650B. There's a tire that's been dug up from the dust bins of Randonneuri. It's an excellent tire and now morphed into a mountain bike tire. So I don't, something else is going on. I'm not laying the blame on the dealers. If they're willing to stock all this other junk, I don't think 650C was really an issue. I think it comes down to more a case of reducing manufacturing costs. But one complaint you do hear, and I don't think it's a real one, is this wheel is smaller compared to my friends with 700C. So if I do have the same gearing, I really am going to go slower. And that is not really necessarily true. But yes, if you were in the same gearing for the same number of revolutions of the pedals, you're not going to go as far. We're talking about something really minor, and all you have to do is shift up a gear. You know, I mean, I say to women who worry about that, if you are in your highest gear on this bike and spinning at 80 RPM, you'll be going 35 miles an hour. Is that satisfactory? I still want 700C. So that, you know, that really shouldn't be an issue, but you do hear about that. All right, so that's the geometry lesson of this. And let me just show you, let me go back to this part of it now. And I want to just show you a comparison here so you get an idea. We've been talking about bikes with three different wheel sizes here. Here's, are we live? Yeah. Here's Brand X, and this is an honest-to-gosh Brand X. I pulled the dimensions of this bike right off their website. This is the smallest bike this particular manufacturer makes. And a woman 410 can straddle this bike without any problem at all. I mean, that top tube is sloped like that. It's really low. A child can stand over this bike. It's not an issue. The problem is, this is where a sloping top tube can be a little bit misleading sometimes. You go into the bike store, you stand over the bike and go, I can stand over it. Oh my gosh, I've never been able to stand over a bike. It must fit me. But it doesn't really. I've set this bike up knowing that a woman 410 usually has about 26-inch inseam. Therefore, her saddle should be that high. I know what this dimension is. So when she gets this bike set up for her, this is how it's going to look when it's all set up, given the way this manufacturer supplies this bike, stem size, spacing, everything. And one of the dimensions, keep an eye on this one up here, this 568.8 millimeters, I call that the rider compartment, and that is you to the end of the handlebars. This is what we're concerned about. So this manufacturer is saying to really small women, this is my solution for you. Here's what this manufacturer gave up by not using a 24-inch design. Here's a 24-inch front wheel on this bike. The rider compartment is a full, what is that, about 20 millimeters shorter. So 26 millimeters shorter, which is about an inch or so. The handlebars are lower, can be raised more. Notice that when you're back in this position, you can't get the handlebars really much lower. I mean, you can play around with the stem and try and flip one down. But this woman, I mean, this is critical. You've got to be able to get this position right, the relationship between the handlebars and the saddle. Some people want it a little bit higher. Some people want it lower. Some people want it at the same height. I always say to people, when you buy a bicycle and it's been adjusted to fit you, don't leave the shop unless some further adjustment can be done. I mean, you should still be able to move the seat back a little bit if you want to, or forward, or raise or lower the handlebars. You don't want to leave the shop on a bike that has you up against a brick wall right off the bat, because you don't know how you're going to change. 20 years from now, you may still be riding that bike and go, you know, I'm stronger now than I ever was. Drop those handlebars an inch. So this bike is kind of locked in. I mean, she's stuck. God help her if she wants to come down anymore. So there it is in comparison to the 24. Now, here it is with 650C wheels. This manufacturer probably had this bike at one time, and here's what the difference would have been. A significantly shorter rider compartment, the ability to raise and lower the handlebars more, but still not comfortable using the 650C wheel. And the other thing I should point out is, here's a perfect example of trying to get to as short a top tube as you can by monkeying around with the seat angle. He's gone all the way out to 74.5. And look here, 70.3 for the head angle, which is pretty darn shallow for a road bike. So games are being played to try and get this thing as short as you can, still keep 700C wheels on it. But what he couldn't get right is how everything stacked up on the vertical side, which is kind of an issue. All right, what time are we? All right, so now I think we should take a break and go out and get some coffee or a snack or do whatever and leave, you know, whatever, and then come back in and I'll be glad to take questions. I know I've been very general about stuff and I probably left you hanging on some things, and I'd be more than happy to get down to more specifics. So that's it.